May it please the Court, Jonathan Henderson for Defendant Appellants. As you're no doubt aware, this case has many issues and has been extensively briefed. There's over 200 cases cited in the briefing, and as a result, I'm going to take kind of a 35,000-foot approach and then come in on some of the issues that I think are worth getting into a little more detail, but I don't think I'll have time to address each and every point that was raised in the briefs. And I'll do my best.
We know that.
I'll do my best to answer the questions you may have, but I'm going to begin with defendants' three assignments. The first assignment of error by defendants was the decision by the district court to permit the meal break claims or violations to proceed when those claims were only brought up for the first time at summary judgment. And defendants had objected on the grounds that it was unfair and prejudicial and they hadn't received enough notice. The district court noted that the plaintiffs exerted a remarkable effort to hide their theories of the case, but nevertheless permitted the claim to proceed.
Let me ask you a question, Counsel, Mr. Regan. Was there a motion by the plaintiffs to amend their complaint to conform to proof?
No.
All right. Thank you.
In your view, it's absolutely clear that there's no way to construe the complaint as referring to these claims?
Well, the complaint is what the district court called a model of scarcity, and so
it's open-ended.
It's open-ended. And what he described, what Judge Mossman described is as basically a Pandora's box that springs open at trial. But as I said, nevertheless allowed these two, the state and the federal claims, to proceed. And in addition to the unfair surprise or the prejudice argument, defendants argued that there really is no basis under state law for the claims because plaintiffs are limited into those meal break violations to.
Let's take the issues apart. Let's start with the surprise. Was there really surprise? When was it known that meal breaks were part of the mix?
This came up during summary judgment, which was 1 month
before
trial.
By that time, at least, I mean, the judge ruled in favor of your client on some aspects with regard to not properly putting issues on the table, in particular with regard to those persons and those claims that were not specified in the summary judgment memorandum. So he seemed to be saying, look, if it was on the table, clearly identified as an issue at the time of summary judgment, I'll let it go forward. And if it wasn't, I won't. Now, I take it you like it that he didn't allow the other claims to go forward. What's wrong with allowing claims that are on the table by the time of summary judgment from going forward?
Well, he essentially found that the vague complaint was sufficient to allow the claims to go forward.
Well, you knew by the time of summary judgment that meal breaks were at issue. What's wrong with that?
It was a month before trial.
Fine. What's wrong with that? I mean, you can amend things if there'd been a motion to amend to conform the complaint to conform to proof. That's permitted under the rules. So how is it that he's not allowed to grant such a motion at the time of summary judgment a month before trial?
Well, I guess it's important to note that he didn't grant a motion to amend to conform
But he allowed these claims.
That's right.
Okay. So practically speaking, he did for these claims. And what was wrong with that?
Well, our position was that plaintiffs had years, I mean, many, many months to bring this.
The real question is, were you unfairly prejudiced by not knowing until a month before trial? And I haven't seen that you were. Why was your client unfairly prejudiced on that issue?
Well, we were able to put on evidence to try to rebut those claims, so.
So I guess you weren't. So what's the next reason that meal breaks shouldn't be on the table?
Pardon
me, you said a moment ago that the judge didn't allow a motion to amend. Was the motion ever made?
A motion was never made, Judge.
Then why did you say he didn't allow it?
There was no motion ever filed. He allowed the claims to go forward on the vague complaint that had been filed.
All right. So it's not a matter of the judge denying a motion to amend. It's a matter of the claims being identified, as Judge Clifton has indicated, in the motion for summary judgment, and the judge making a determination that you were not unfairly prejudiced by bringing them up for trial.
That's right. We had made the argument that it's unfair to bring a new theory in response to a motion for summary judgment. The judge looked at the cases on both sides and ultimately decided he's going to allow those claims.
When you made your argument that it was unfair, Did you make any argument that you needed more time to prepare your defense and ask for a continuance?
No. And our pitch was that there was a pattern of practice of changing theories and that we should be entitled to.
What does that mean? I mean, it was sort of like, you know, this is a good thing to do to discipline the plaintiff's counsel for being sloppy or something like that?
I guess I wouldn't say discipline, but what we were trying to do is rein them in so we knew what claims were going to be going forward to trial.
You knew that. You knew that.
We did at that point, but that was the third or fourth iteration of the claims, and we just said enough is enough.
Did you make a motion for continuance to conduct further discovery to flesh out these claims?
We didn't.
All right.
So, but the other prong to this argument is that the claim is simply not supported by state law. That the claim, the state law claim for meal break violations, the recourse is for plaintiffs to file a complaint with Bully. Plaintiffs have distinguished the case that we cited on the grounds that those plaintiffs in that case sought essentially extra pay, pay for time that they had not worked. That case involved a class of plaintiffs who alleged they weren't given their rest period breaks and that they were entitled to 20 minutes of extra pay each day for that, and the court said that there is no claim for that. Well, here the claim is similar enough that it should be that case law should be followed. Here the essence of the claim is that although we got the 10-minute breaks, that some employees on some occasions clocked back in earlier than the full 30 minutes, and therefore they should be entitled to the two 10-minute breaks and a separate 29-minute break, all of which should be compensated. So,
well, that sounds like a jury argument. I mean, presumably your client did argue to the jury that the clocking in at 29 minutes was the voluntary act by a plaintiff.
That's right.
Jury awarded what it awarded.
But our pitch was just that under the Oregon case law that the claim shouldn't ever go to the jury. It should go to Bowley based on the Oregon case law.
How about the federal claim?
The federal claim is premised on the same set of facts in that it's slightly different than Oregon law, but their pitch is that if there's any time or any meal break that's less than 30 minutes, then it doesn't count as a bona fide meal period, and therefore it's wrong to deduct that time. There's no support for that under federal case law. The case that, or statutes. The case that they cited for that proposition is from this court. It's the Brennan versus Elmer case in which plaintiffs asserted stands for the proposition that any break less than 30 minutes under the FLSA is not a bona fide meal break. That case doesn't say that. It's nowhere in that opinion. In that case, the employers encouraged the employees to work through their lunch breaks. The employees worked through their lunch breaks, and the employer still deducted a half hour of time every day. And the court said, in order to be bona fide meal break, you have to be relieved of your duties. They weren't relieved of their duties. It was wrong to deduct that time. In our case, there was no evidence that the employees were required to work during the time that they had clocked out for their meal break. It was only that they had sometimes clocked back in less than the full 30 minutes had expired. We've cited sources in our brief from federal agencies in which they said that a meal period of less than 30 minutes is sufficient to constitute a bona fide meal period under FLSA. And in one instance, I believe it was in the Sixth Circuit, they held that a 20-minute meal period was sufficient to constitute a bona fide meal period. So our position is that these claims under the FLSA were simply that they didn't meet the burden and that the claims should have never went forward because the evidence was that these 1 minute or 2 minute or 3 minute early clock-ins were not actionable. Under the case law, the FLSA, involving the FLSA, you're not required to pay literally every single minute of time that was worked. And so these de minimis, these 1 and 2 minute shortened meal periods don't then become rest periods or lose the status of bona fide meal periods such that they're actionable.
Well, let me focus. your attention on a different issue that you may not get to unless I ask you to speak to it. And it has to do with one of the decisions of the district court in your client's favor with regard to the non-testifying plaintiffs. And my question is, what was the prejudice, or what would have been the prejudice to your client if those claims had been permitted to go to the jury, because under circumstances where those individuals were not present to testify?
Well, the prejudice would be the inability to cross-examine the witnesses and to permit the jury and to judge the truthfulness or the witness's testimony.
Well, the jury doesn't have to judge a truthfulness if they don't testify.
Sure. I guess I'm not following.
Well, you know, the underlying issue is there some rule that says in a civil case the plaintiff has to be in court?
No, but
can you cite me that rule?
No, I can't
then
cite you that rule.
What was the basis of the district court's decision?
The district court exercised its discretion and held that in two instances.
Where did the discretion come from?
The discretion to conduct or to control the proceedings in the judge's courtroom.
But what's the justification for, in effect, extinguishing claims? It wasn't simply that some evidence wasn't permitted to be submitted. The claims didn't go to the jury. That's not simply controlling evidence.
The district court had earlier ruled that it would not permit this same group of plaintiffs to testify, I believe it was via telephone.
Fine. And there's no testimony from those plaintiffs. But there was factual information regarding payments to them and hours and so forth. Why is it that evidence couldn't have been submitted to the jury as proof of whatever claim plaintiffs had? What was missing that defendants didn't have the opportunity to examine them about?
Well, the same information that was elicited on cross-examination with regard to some of the witnesses that were there, for instance, that they were required, that nobody told them they were supposed
to. Didn't you have the opportunity to take their deposition?
We did.
And you can use a party's deposition for any purpose, right? You could have just introduced a deposition testimony if you thought you had something favorable. I don't understand the basis of the district court's decision to say you can't present your claim. I never heard of that.
Well, it's true that the effect was to take away the claims because they weren't there to testify. But the ruling was you've got to be here to testify or else I'm not going to allow you to proceed.
Well, that's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same.
So if he doesn't have the right to decide, well, I don't like this claim, so it's not going to the jury, I mean, there's got to be a legal basis for it. And if there's no requirement for a plaintiff to be there, what exactly is the insufficiency of proof? I mean, the theory of it is that there's not sufficient proof to go to the jury. But why isn't the record enough to say that these people worked these hours and weren't paid this money?
Well, the distinction we made, I guess, in the case law that's been cited is that if you look at the cases decided by a plaintiff, in most of those cases there were hundreds and in some instances thousands of employees. And in those cases there was a pattern or systemic practice that was identified. And so, for instance, if it was a case in which the employees said, it's a practice here that we all work more than 40 regular hours during the week and that as a practice none of us ever get paid time and a half for the hours that are over 40 hours a week, and we can establish that through the records. That's not what happened here. All these plaintiffs had different claims which were constantly changing, and their theories were constantly changing throughout the case. And
well,
so
it's all just a matter of proof. If they can't put on their proof, they can't put on their proof. But that's not reason to deny them the opportunity to put their proof on.
Well, our position is that it was within the discretion of the trial court, and that it was not an abuse of discretion. I'm going to not get into the Lodestar stuff because I've addressed the issue that the attorney fee award was attached to the FLSA claim. Our position is that claim should have never gone forward, or that it fails under the federal case law because it's simply not an actionable claim under the FLSA.
I think the other point you raise on your appeal has to do with the late payments, right, or the late paychecks. Didn't you appeal that ruling?
We did not appeal that piece. The other piece to our the other assignment from the defendants was the failure of the trial court to make findings regarding the sanctions, that the discovery sanctions that were issued against defendants.
And there were no findings, right?
There were no findings. And so
did he say something that gave a hint?
No, there was just minute, two terse minute orders granting
There's
the
There's not much doubt from the record that, in fact, defendants hadn't responded on a very prompt basis to discovery requests.
There is evidence on the record that may support
Pretty sad record. It went through four or five different iterations of a response.
That's right.
Well, is it really hard to figure out what it was the district court was trying to sanction?
Well, the
fairly modest sanctions at that.
Well, our position was that it's an attorney fee sanction and that we should have been permitted to at least challenge the reasonableness or the amount of the attorney fees.
$9,000?
Well,
for a series of discovery problems? You don't think attorney's fees would exceed $9,000?
Well, no. I'm not arguing
they
that
have
it was unreasonable.
That, look, they got their attorney's fees elsewhere. But
well, this is why this sanction issue is compounded, because later the trial court accepted what it had found during the sanction proceedings without being challenged regarding the reasonableness of the fees charged.
Well, but it didn't make any findings.
It didn't make any findings. How can it
accept the findings that were not made?
Well, implicit in granting the award of attorney fees is that it had to necessarily find that they were reasonable, or the amount charged was reasonable, and that later when it had awarded fees, it simply went forward with those amounts. And so our position was, well, geez, we never really got a chance to challenge that, and there's nothing on the record that for you to review. So
you have a little more than 3 minutes left if you want to
show. Sure. I do want to save. I want to save some time for rebuttal, if you don't mind.
You can save this or whatever fraction you want.
I'll save this amount of time.
OK.
Thanks, Judge.
May it please the Court. My name is John Egan. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff employees in this case. I want to start off, Judge Bea, by saying that the plaintiffs did move in the alternative in their summary judgment materials to amend to conform to the evidence that had been submitted in support of the summary judgment exhibits. Should the judge view that as required, we did move in the alternative.
How do you mean move in the alternative? I move for summary judgment or I move to amend my Second Amendment complaint?
Well,
could you give me a page citation on that?
I can. The defendants moved for summary judgment partially on the things that had been brought up for the first time in writing at the summary judgment, because they had been brought up for the first time. And so plaintiffs told the judge, if you think that it's necessary that these appear in the complaint, we move in the alternative to add them to the complaint. But we don't think that it's necessary to have them appear in the complaint. And the judge accepted that argument, so it wasn't necessary to. But I did want to let you know that we did move in the alternative to amend the complaint.
Give me a citation.
I can. I think that would be document 142. I don't believe it's in the excerpt of record, but it would have been docket number 142 in the underlying case.
Okay. I'll take a look at that.
What is the document 142?
Oh, that's plaintiff's reply in support of their motion for summary judgment. There were joint briefings on both sides to cover both sides' summary judgment.
Your position was that you offered as an alternative in that pleading to move to amend, and the judge said that won't be necessary.
The judge denied the defendant's summary judgment based on their claim of surprise. He said that while it may not be common, it's at least acceptable to present new theories. And by the way, this wasn't a new theory at summary judgment, but he said even if it had been, it's acceptable to present new theories on summary judgment, and so I don't view it as necessary to amend the complaint.
Assuming, would you say he said it was not necessary?
Yes.
And do you have a transcript citation to that?
not to the page, but that was transcribed. September 3rd, excuse me, was the summary judgment hearing, September 3rd, 2010.
You know, it really would be helpful if you were to give us the citations to the transcript so that we don't have to spend our time or the clerk's time looking up what you should cite to us.
Sure. I can send that to you in 28-J letter. Okay.
Now you give me a citation. We'll look at it, but no. Go ahead.
Okay. I thought that I would spend my time addressing the plaintiff's assignment of error unless the Court has questions regarding the defendants. First, I would like to point out the Biggs issue. It was brought to the trial court's attention that in the Ninth Circuit and almost every other circuit, certainly all of the 81 courts that have interpreted Biggs, that it holds that minimum wages are not paid if they're not paid on payday, and that employees are entitled to liquidated damages under the FLSA, whether the underlying paycheck is paid later or not. The right to liquidated damages accrues on payday when minimum wage is not paid, and that goes for overtime as well. Both of those findings are explicit in the Biggs opinion, and that was pointed out to the trial court, and he rejected that opinion. So I think that it's clear under all of the authority that
What kind of damage did you get for late payment? Like, these are like a day late, right?
A day or two or four, but liquidated damages accrue on payday if the minimum wage is not paid.
And what are the liquidated damages?
It would be the amount of the minimum wage times the number of hours the employee worked during that pay period. Or
for each day of lateness or what?
No, just ever. It's a set.
You mean a single penalty for being late?
Correct. That's the liquidated.
And that's under the what case?
That's under the Biggs versus Wilson case.
Biggs, yeah, okay.
Yeah. And it's section 206 and 207 of the FLSA.
Now, you also had a similar claim under state law, right?
Correct. That specific issue hasn't been decided under state law, but the ingredients are all there. The Smurfit case that we cited in our materials said that prejudgment interest starts running on state law punitive damages awards under the penalty wage statute starting 31 days after the payday. And for the same reason, statute of limitations starts running on the payday because that's the day that they're due.
Well, what about the Herger case?
The Herger case specifically said it was addressing two different due dates. Under Oregon's final pay statute, wages are due to an employee on either the day of or the day after their termination. That's different than the due dates for minimum wage and overtime, which is on the regular payday. Herger specifically carved out our case by saying that we're not addressing, and it may be that in certain cases, what's late for one statute may also be late for the other statute.
Well, it said the statute at issue there wasn't part of the statute designed to implement minimum wage. Why is the statute here part of the minimum wage scheme as opposed to late payment scheme?
Well, this is the minimum wage scheme. I mean, we're alleging
about you're arguing it is, but why is what is it about late payment for a terminated employee that's particularly different from late payment for a currently employed employee?
The Oregon legislature in ORS 652.140 and 145 has said that employees should get their final paychecks right away. For whatever reason, the Oregon legislature has viewed that as important. It says that people need the minimum wage and overtime on payday, but when an employee is terminated, all of their wages are due by either the day after or 5 days after, depending if they're terminated or if they quit.
If you're covered by the federal statute, does it matter whether there's an Oregon law provision?
It does because there's different penalties. The purpose of FLSA...
Get both?
Yes, you can. Under Oregon state law, you can get both. Oregon penalties are viewed as punitive, and FLSA liquidated damages are viewed as compensatory to the employee for not having got their money on time. So because they have two different purposes, all of the Oregon district judges have ruled that you can award both federal and state penalties.
Now, if we can switch a little bit, in addition to barring all claims of these plaintiffs, you know, who didn't appear in the trial court, the judge also barred certain claims from other plaintiffs, right?
Correct.
And the basis of that was what, that ruling?
He said that it was basically an unfair surprise type of argument. The defendants in this case never submitted interrogatories. The parties waived initial disclosures.
Well, just a minute. When he said it was unfair surprise, was that in response to a motion made by the defendants?
It was. Their motion in limine just prior to the trial. They moved to exclude any evidence that hadn't been contained in the summary judgment memorandum.
And obviously you're taking the position that was error, right?
Yes.
All right. Tell me why.
Because the plaintiffs responded to every request that the defendants made. There's case law in the Ninth.
Discovery request isn't the same as articulating a claim. I mean, the complaint was, I'll say open-ended.
It was.
The district judge, in effect, looked at the summary judgment and said, okay, that's going to be the articulation of what's allowed and what's not. And he allowed you to pursue the meal break claim, even though there was nothing specifically articulated about that before. But he didn't allow you to come up with whatever else you could glean from the data afterwards. And what's wrong with that decision?
Well, it wasn't afterwards. In our summary judgment memorandum, we set out the different types of theories under which the plaintiffs had been unpaid. And we put out one or two specific examples to walk the judge through the application of the law to the particular time and pay records as to how you figure this out, given the records that we've given. And then my declaration submitted in support of the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment had all of the spreadsheets laying out for every particular day and every particular week and pay period, these are all the violations for this day and pay period.
Looking at the spreadsheets, I don't know that it's unfair to say, gee, defendants can't be expected to figure out from the spreadsheets exactly what claims are being articulated. It sounds to me like you're responding by saying you did say in your summary judgment memorandum what claims were being pursued.
Did.
Well, what is it that the district court excluded that met the test that he appeared to be applying?
So, for example, one of our claims was that the defendants changed their work week, the day upon which their work week started, several times during the plaintiff's employment. And that has overtime implications under both state and federal law. We stated one such example in the text of our summary judgment memorandum. The other examples were contained in the spreadsheets. He said that we could only put before the jury the specific date that we had mentioned in the summary judgment memorandum and not the ones that were contained in the spreadsheets because we hadn't drawn enough attention to them so that the defendants would know that those specific violations were at issue.
There was no, you know, I'll call it like a comprehensive pretrial proceedings where you laid out all your contentions and so forth?
There was.
And were these claims contained in your pretrial statement?
Absolutely.
And when did the court make the ruling barring you from pursuing those claims?
He said in response to the defendant's motion in limine, he said that.
Well, the motion in limine was made when? After the pretrial conference?
At the same pretrial conference.
At the pretrial conference, all right.
They filed the pleadings ahead of time, but the ruling was made at the pretrial conference several days before trial. And so it's plaintiff's position that
And the basis of the ruling was that what? It was surprise?
The defendants were claiming unfair surprise. We should point out that under Ninth Circuit and District of Oregon law, there's no requirement to specifically list theories or dates of violations in the complaint. The case law is pretty specific that that's left up to discovery, to discover those sorts of things, and the defendants never asked any questions except on the eve of summary judgment, and plaintiffs answered all of those questions with their exhibits, which with a rounding claim is really the only way you can answer those questions. You know, they say, tell us which weeks and what are the amounts of each of the types of violations at issue. When you're dealing with a rounding claim, which we were at that point before the judge dismissed the rounding claim at summary judgment, at every day, how much time each plaintiff works is different every day. I mean, you have to list them out by day to give the defendant all of the information that they're asking for. So that's what we did. I mean, there's – and we summarized them by week, by pay period, and by plaintiff in terms of the totals of each of the kinds of damages that we were asking for. So,
on the spreadsheet, but not on the motion for summary judgment.
Correct. Yeah. I think Your Honors hit the nail on the head with the non-testifying employees. I don't think there's any –
What evidence was – had been submitted by the time the plaintiff's case in chief closed as to those employees?
We tried – all of the – every plaintiff, testifying and non-testifying, had had their time and pay records pre-submitted, pre-authenticated, and pre-admitted as exhibits before the first day of trial. Everyone's time and pay records had an exhibit number, and as far as plaintiffs knew, we were going to be able to go to the jury. That's how we argued Joey Law's claims. She was the one who was in Hong Kong. She didn't testify, and the judge allowed us to argue to the jury, here are the four dates upon which we're alleging she had unpaid meal claims. Look at the records. Here's the pages in the records that show those. And the jury was able to go through and figure it out and confirm, yes, those violations did happen. That each of the types of violations and the patterns and practices of the company were provable by the representative evidence of the 19 plaintiffs who did testify. So they knew the types of violations that happened. They knew about how they happened and how to figure it out from the records. All they would have had to do is been allowed access to those records. The judge did not send those records back to the jury because he dismissed their claims instead. But those were the records that were already in evidence before the trial began.
You got about 5 minutes left. You know, you want to say something about didn't you appeal the amount of the attorney's fees award?
I did. There are two issues there. One is the denial of attorney fees under Oregon state law on the basis that plaintiff's counsel, the judge found that plaintiff's counsel unreasonably failed to give written notice of the wage claim to the defendants before the litigation. Lauren Rother gave pre-litigation notice of her claim.
And what did her notice say?
It said, please pay me all that you owe me. Before the litigation
pretty
began.
Specific, isn't it? I mean, how is the defendant supposed to react to that?
Well, it's supposed to call me. I mean, that was what I said in my letter as well. I also wrote a letter to the defendants asking.
A call, a question would be, okay, what do you say we owe?
And then and what I said was, right now all we know about is her final paycheck. I can give you a to-the-penny figure on how much you owe if you'll give me her time and pay records. And I'm willing to work with you to come up with a number. They refused to give me those time and pay records before the litigation
began. How much time passed
between
the letter and the lawsuit?
Between her first letter was on January 15th. My letter was on January 21st. My follow-up letter saying, you know, that you've refused to give me these records was on January 31st. And the case was filed on February 7th when we didn't hear back anything. This is not like the Belknap case where the plaintiffs were actively hiding the ball and denying requests by the defendant for information. This is the opposite of that case where the plaintiffs were actively seeking the documents upon which to give a to-the-penny estimate of a settlement figure, and the defendants were denying them access to those records, which is how they would have figured it out. And so that's the denial of attorney fees under state law. The trial judge also double-reduced the attorney fees under federal law by removing hours from the Lodestar that plaintiffs had conceded had been spent on either plaintiffs that had been dismissed or claims that had been dismissed. And he accepted that reduction. And then he applied a further 40% reduction for the same alleged lack of success on the claims. And so that's a double reduction. Case law is clear that if a reason for reduction is already subsumed within the Lodestar, you're not supposed to.
The Lodestar reduction was relatively modest, and the number of hours taken out weren't very great. He could have skipped that and applied the second reduction, because there is a pretty substantial difference between the 400 and some odd dollars that were awarded and the well over $200,000 in attorney's fees that were claimed.
Well, he could have, but he didn't. He accepted the plaintiff's proposed reduction, and then he...
And maybe he said that's not enough. I mean, do you have many cases that support a $250,000 in fees for $400 of damages when there's no other injunctive relief involved?
There's lots of cases that say, especially in FLSA cases and other fee-shifting cases, the size of the fees is primarily determined by the choices that the defendant makes throughout the litigation, not the plaintiff. The size of the
affected by the choices of what claims that are unsuccessful that are pursued. And depending on how we resolve some of these other issues, a substantial number of claims that were pursued were unsuccessful.
That's
I don't
true.
Know that the plaintiff's voluntary reduction fairly reflects the amount of lack of success.
He could have found that. But what he did was he came to a final lodestar figure and say, I view this as the reasonable hours that it took to come to this result. And then he further reduced that for a lack of success.
What's your position on, hypothetically, for instance, if you prevail on any of the other claims, does that require the vacation of the attorney's fees award? So, because they have to be, because they should be recomputed?
No, because there's overlap. There were lots of work that went into this case that would have had to been put in, whether the plaintiffs had only been successful on the claims that they asserted that they won on, or whether the other claims. So in other words, that's why there was not much that ended up being taken out, both by plaintiff's suggestion and by the judge's acceptance.
Well, I don't think you get my question. I mean, for instance, hypothetically, suppose you were to prevail on your claim that the district court erred in excluding the seven, claims of the seven plaintiffs who were absent, right?
Yes.
Then does that require the attorney's fees award to be vacated because you should get more money for that?
No, we would apply for supplemental fees for
proof. It would be a separate award.
Yes. You would only need to vacate the current attorney fee award if you were to grant any of defendants' assignments of error.
Right.
I've got limited time left. What I would like to suggest is that under the Ninth Circuit, the standard for reassignment to a new district judge upon remand is that the district judge may have difficulty setting aside the findings and opinions that they've expressed up to date if on remand, if any of the things are reversed. And we suggest that the district judge is ignoring current Ninth Circuit law is a basis for that, and the case law supports that as well.
Is that something you mentioned in your brief?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
Did you learn anything different about the district judge's treatment of this case since you filed your briefs?
No. That was, it's just
this one out of your hat, huh?
Well, it's not a motion. It's just a suggestion. I think it can only be done sua sponte.
Well, parties suggested a lot.
I'm not prepared to address the last issue brought up. I haven't looked at the case law or the rules, or it's a surprise to me. So I'm going to address quickly here some of the things that counsel addressed. First, the pre-litigation notice issue. We've briefed this fairly extensively, but the statute or
the notice required by state law for attorney's fees?
Yes, as the penalty under ORS 652150.
Right. Go ahead.
Our position, obviously, is that just sending a letter that simply says, you owe me, and a name is not sufficient. The statutes are remedial statutes. They're designed to prevent litigation, and that notice is simply not enough.
But if I understood counsel, that was on the 15th of January, and he wrote another letter saying that if you tell me how many hours she worked, I'll tell you how much she's claiming, and then you didn't follow up and tell her those.
We didn't follow up quickly enough is what, I guess, what is his.
Well, that's on the 21st, and they filed 3 weeks later on the 7th of February.
That's right.
In that period of time, you didn't say anything about the hours worked, right?
That's right. The statute doesn't require the defense to, or the employer to go through this exercise. It requires the.
Yeah, but he's telling you he couldn't tell you how much he's claiming until he knew the amount of hours she worked. I mean, what you're saying is she ought to have her own records of how many hours she worked?
Well, at least identify a theory such that I didn't get my overtime or you didn't give me my check soon enough or just something. Something on there. So we at least
somebody
know
what doing in response to her letter.
What's that?
What did the company do in response to her letter?
Well, it hired an attorney, and
Was there any effort on the part of the company to try to figure out, okay, what's the problem? I mean, presumably they knew about the last paycheck not being paid.
I mean, there was an effort. It's not in the record, but as I understand it, the argument is that it wasn't prompt enough or it wasn't a quick enough effort to identify what it is that they're looking for and to provide records for that. I guess our position is simply that if you just say, look, you gave me my last check too late, or you didn't give me overtime or something.
He did ask you to give her, to give him the hours she worked.
That's right.
Can you be precise on what more the notice should have contained?
At least identify the theory. I don't think that's too onerous for an employee to say, look, I was terminated or I quit on this day and I didn't get my paycheck for a certain amount of time, or there are certain days which, if you could send me the records, I can identify which days that you didn't pay me for, just something other than you owe me. There's no case law in Oregon on that issue, but I'd submit that something more is needed than that. I'm running out of time here. On the Biggs issue, there's...
You have run out of time.
What's that?
The red light is on. The number is a negative.
I did exactly what you warned me not to do.
Yeah, but not much, so we'll excuse this deficit.
Thanks, Judge.
The case to start, you just submitted. We thank both counsel for your helpful arguments. That concludes the calendar for today. We're adjourned.